Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The war in Afghanistan has gone on now for nearly 10 years, and U.S. Army Major Rusty Bradley has been there almost the whole time. He was there in 2002, right after 9/11, and just 2 weeks ago, he returned from his fifth deployment there. He's a special forces officer. Like all Green Berets, he's been trained to fight, and he's done a lot of it. But he's done it alongside Afghan soldiers. He calls them the Lions of Kandahar, and that's the title of his new book. This hour, On Point, the Special Forces and the Endgame in Afghanistan. You can join the conversation. Have you served in Afghanistan? Are you optimistic about the future of that country as American forces pull back? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Rusty Bradley, a U.S. Army major and author of the new book, Lions of Kandahar, The Story of a Fight Against All Odds. The book chronicles a harrowing battle fought between U.S. Special Forces and their Afghan allies against the Taliban in 2006. It goes on sale tomorrow. Rusty Bradley, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tam. Tom, how are you? Thank you
Good.
For having me.
Yeah, terrific. Listen, five deployments. That's incredible. How unusual, how remarkable it is that you have been deployed five times to Afghanistan in the last 9 years. Give us a sense of that nine-year period, the rhythm of deployment and coming back home again.
It's been extremely busy. When we first arrived in 2002, we definitely had a significant momentum. There was no capacity for the enemy. The Afghan people were very shocked and awestruck that we were able to accomplish in probably less than 6 months with a few special forces soldiers what the Soviets couldn't do with 100 divisions in 10 years. So between that initial arrival and the point we're at today, there's been quite a few peaks and valleys that the struggle's gone through.
And how about in your own life? I mean, five deployments. You have a family, right?
Yes, sir, I do.
And so tell us.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Now tell us what it's been like to be going back and forth to Afghanistan for 9 years.
It's difficult. It's almost to the point where it's so difficult to describe because you have to be you have to be married to the right person. I think that military families are probably our true great heroes because they're the ones who stay at home and sacrifice in silence while their husbands and their loved ones are at war.
And it's got to be harder on your kids, too.
It's extremely difficult. I mean, you miss births of children. You miss most of the holidays, anniversaries, and for us, I think the biggest thing that it's done is it's given us a new level of appreciation for who we are as a couple and for our country, because you have to go through and experience things that other people don't do, and you go through the full range of emotions that it's unfair. But yet, at the end of the day, you know, I look at my family with a sense of pride in that they have allowed me to completely deploy and be as effective as I need to be on the battlefield because they took care of everything while I was gone. So they serve as well.
Sure. And your kids, I mean, you've gotten to know them and then left and come back. I mean, that's got to be difficult, too, as a father.
Yeah, that's probably that's the hardest part. You can continue to work on your relationship with your spouse, but at the end of the day, you know, you leave and, you know, your child is bundled up in your arms and you come home and they've got ponytails and listening to iPods and they're, you know, this boy's cute or that girl's cute. So you miss some pretty significant pieces of their life that you know you can't get back. But at the end of the day, I think you know that that's part of the sacrifice you bear as a soldier, especially during this time when our country needs us most. We can't we're not taught to be selfish, and our families reflect that as well as we do.
How many kids you got, Rusty, and how old are they now?
1 and 12.
So it's fair to say that the last decade of your life has been really shaped by this Afghanistan experience. You were never deployed to Iraq, always to Afghanistan over these last 9 years?
That's correct, Tom.
And what feeling does that give you about the mission in Afghanistan, the war in Afghanistan? You know, we were so focused on Afghanistan in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 because that's where Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda had taken refuge. Then our attention got shifted to Iraq. Now it's back in Afghanistan again. But your focus throughout this period has been Afghanistan. I mean, you must have come to feel quite strongly. You've got a lot invested in this particular war in Afghanistan. Can you talk about that?
Yes, sir, I can talk about that. I mean, most of us have taken the stance that, you know, we're going to do everything possible to see that the Afghan, you know, the end state for us is that the Afghan people and the Afghan nation can survive on their own. They want to be free. That is, I think, something that has been completely and totally missed is the fact that the Afghan people have never known what freedom is. And when you work with them, let me give you a real quick example. I've got there was a 17-year-old young man that started working for us. His father had been a teacher. They were persecuted by the Taliban when they lived in Kandahar City. And he started out knowing a few English words and immediately was recognized by one of the teams that was there, and they made him a work supervisor, and he eventually became an interpreter and went everywhere that the team went. We eventually were able to get him off the battlefield because we had grown very close to him, and now he is a small businessman who's able to care for not just his family but his extended family. And the things that we've been able to teach him and what he has done with the freedoms that we've granted him can't even be measured. So they want to be free. They want to succeed. They are trying the best they can, but they're facing so many challenges. Their country's so far behind where the rest of the world is that it's taken work, and you've got to have outreach. You've got to be able to, I mean, the people just want to, they just want to be safe. They want to grow their crops and their farms. Yeah. They want a chance. And what we're seeing more and more every day is that given that opportunity, they will take that risky step, which is so far outside of their social, tribal, and cultural norm to want to have that one opportunity, to be free and to have their own country, to make their own laws, to go as they choose. And they're really starting to recognize that there's only a few people that are trying to prevent that, and that's the insurgents.
Now, Rusty, as a Special Forces officer, it was your mission to work very closely with the Afghans. That's the special mission of the Special Forces. But much of your book focuses on a 2006 battle near Kandahar where you fought wave after wave of Taliban forces. I'd like you to read a brief portion of the book where you describe being wounded. And I think that this takes place as you try to defend a hill there, Sperwan Gar. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Could you read that section for us, please?
Yes. Letting the machine gun hang in the gun mount, I sprinted for the cache in a nearby ditch. An A&A machine gun positioned to my right rattled away as I ran. Sliding into the 4-foot deep canal, my knees rebelled. Pain shot through my joints and I felt old. The machine guns brought me out of my funk. I snatched 4 boxes of ammunition climbing out of the ditch and took a step when I was overwhelmed by intense heat and pressure. I lost all sense of control and balance. An RPG or recoilless rifle had exploded somewhere near my left front, hurling me violently back into the ditch. I landed on my left shoulder, followed by the rest of my 230-pound frame and another 50 pounds of equipment. I couldn't feel my shoulder anymore. I clutched it with my right hand just to make sure it was still there. My helmet, sunglasses, and headset were gone. The strap on my left shoulder holding my body armor was shredded, and the plates hung cockeyed across my chest and back. I couldn't focus. Anywhere I looked, I saw stars. I gagged and coughed out the dust and smoke, struggling to keep enough oxygen into my lungs. Dave's 50-caliber machine gun sounded muffled, even though it was only a few feet away. I commanded my left knee to bend so I could roll over, stealing a quick glance at it. I expected to see it shredded. I winced as it bent, but knew that the pain meant it was still connected. I tried to spit out some of the grime out of my mouth, but couldn't muster enough saliva to do it. I struggled to focus. Then panic set in. I didn't want to die.
Rusty, which deployment was that?
That was the third.
So you've been back two more deployments after that. That didn't slow you down.
No, sir.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking to Army Major Rusty Bradley. He joins us from New York City. He's the author of the new book, The Lions of Kandahar. He's an active duty U.S. Army Special Forces officer who's been deployed to Afghanistan five times. At the end of the last segment, Rusty, you read a very dramatic segment from your book where you describe being wounded in the battle to defend a key outpost, a key piece of strategic terrain in Kandahar, in the Kandahar area. Nevertheless, as a special forces officer, much of your mission has to do with training the Afghans to fight. And of course, this is what distinguishes the special forces within the U.S. Army. You write, for example, on page 29, ours was not the typical relationship. We were inherently different. You're talking here about your relationship with your Afghan allies. We ate, slept, lived, and breathed with the Afghan people as if we had done so all our lives, immersing ourselves in their language and culture. Now, Rusty, what made you decide that you wanted to join the Special Forces with this particular mission of training the Afghans?
That's a really interesting question. I studied sociology in college. And little did I know that in the late 80s, the study of societies and culture would benefit me so greatly almost 20 years later. I was in the 82nd Airborne Division with in Kandahar on my first rotation in 2002, and I knew some of the guys that I had served with previously that had gone in Special Forces, and that was the opportunity that I got to truly see what they did and how they operated. And, of course, that fit immediately into what I could see as the rest of my career and the next challenges that I wanted. So that's the reason that I went in Special Forces during right after the – because, I mean, everybody knew that there was not going to be a quick and decisive end to this. We were going to have to rebuild the country. And that meant that we were going to have to help these people long beyond the fighting. So when I applied to go to selection and made it through, I told them that I wanted to focus on one of the Afghan tribal languages. And that's one of the unique things about Special Forces is they make you or they try to make you as proficient in a specific area of the world as possible when you go through your training. And you know, I selected Afghanistan.
And you selected Pashto. You actually learned some Pashto.
I did.
Which is the main language in the south of Afghanistan. It's what the Taliban speak as well, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it is. About 60% of the population in Afghanistan is Pashtun or come from the Pashtun clan. I guess it's learning a language that is not a modern language but an ancient tribal language, which is what Pashtun is. There's about 52 dialects of Pashtun just in Kandahar province, which is maybe 80 miles by 80 miles in all four cardinal directions. So it's a very diverse ancient language. And what's really unique is you pick up a couple of the dialects the longer that you're over there, because you inherently end up dealing with the same people, so you learn all the new words and how to say the words. But what's most important is that how much respect they give you for even trying to learn the language.
Well, that's a really important achievement, because if we put this now, your experience, in the context of what the United States is going to be doing in Afghanistan in the future, as U.S. forces draw down, there obviously will be a greater focus on training Afghan soldiers. Let's take a minute here to sort of look at some of the things that have been said about the war in Afghanistan here just in the last week. First of all, with President Obama, he admitted last week that the road home from Afghanistan will still be a very hard slog.
Of course, huge challenges remain. This is the beginning, but not the end, of our effort to wind down this war. We'll have to do the hard work of keeping the gains that we've made while we draw down our forces and transition responsibility for security to the Afghan government.
And Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island told NBC's David Gregory on Meet the Press yesterday that the challenge now will be shifting responsibility.
Within Afghanistan, we're no longer, I think, talking about nation building. We're talking about stabilization. We're talking about creating a military force that can stabilize that country and take the lead from us and continue, and I think we have to continue to have some type of presence there.
I'm speaking with Rusty Bradley, a major in the U.S. Army's Special Forces and a veteran of five tours of duty in Afghanistan. Now, a couple of important points here that we've heard, Rusty, just in these tape clips. One is Senator Reid saying we're not talking about nation building. First of all, your thoughts on that? I mean, because when you describe in your book what your mission was and what you saw as the end state, you saw it as a lot more than just defeating militants in Afghanistan, correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. I think all too often people get wrapped up in trying to use specific terminology to define what you're trying to do. And then if you use a word, for example, nation building, depending upon who you ask, if you talk to an Afghan and you talk to them about nation building, they'll say you're trying to help them create their country. If it's almost like speaking another language, actually, because if you talk American political talk, they might be saying, for example, nation building is, you know, us trying to establish a U.S. established government in, you know, in another foreign country. So as long as you understand that there's a difference, I understand what they're trying to say. We're not trying to force the Afghans to build a government or a country that is anything other than what the Afghans themselves want and what they're trying to build. But in as far as we are trying to help them build and establish security, governance, and development, you can't do anything without security in Afghanistan. It's been a lawless country with almost 30 years of continuous warfare. And you have to put enough security forces, the right security forces, in the right places to make it safe for these people to want to participate. You have to understand that they have no concept of a unified government because none of their generations have ever known one. You're having to teach them what that is, to teach them what it's like to be proud to, you know, be an Afghani and not necessarily from a particular tribe or from a particular family, because that's what they identify mm-hmm. with. Mm-hmm. So, second line of operation, once you can get security established in a particular area, and that's the full spectrum of Afghan security forces. You've got to have the Afghan National Police. You've got to have the Afghan National Army. You've got to have the Afghan National Civil Order Police. You've got to have, the Afghan Uniform Police. You have to have the things in place. I mean, imagine what it would be like in your neighborhood if there were no police, or if the police were only corrupt and you lived on the fringe of Boston and you were trying to, you know, go to the store or, you know, growing crops and trying to get them to the market. It would never succeed. So,
you know, I don't want to interrupt you, Rusty, but we have a ton of people who want to talk to you. So if we can just take a few minutes, because some of our listeners have questions for you. Let's go first to Julie, who's calling from Shepherdsville, Kentucky. Julie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And you're talking with Army Major Rusty Bradley here. Do you have any questions for him?
No, Mr. Bradley, I just want to thank you for your service to our country.
All right. That's good to hear, isn't it, Major
thank
Bradley?
You. You know, it's quite humbling, actually. Julie, thank you for being a country worth fighting for.
And let's go now to Joe, who's calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dom.
And you're on with Army Major Rusty Bradley.
Hi, Major. I hope you're not tired of hearing. Thank you very much for your service. The American people are indebted to men like you and women like you that lay your life on the line, and it's just an incredible story. I look forward to reading your book. The question I have for you, sir, is out of all the challenges that people like you who are training the Afghan soldiers and police, out of all the challenges, be it a cultural challenge, be it a linguistic challenge, and of course, which I would think is one of the biggest challenges is education, which do you think is the biggest? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Good question, Rusty.
That's a great question, and guess what, Joe? You answered it already. It's education. So many of the Afghans are desperate to have a better life and to try. They want to be a part of something positive. The biggest challenge that we face is we can train anybody. We can go anywhere and do anything we want to do or that the commander-in-chief directs us to go and do. That's a bottom line. But what we have to be willing to do is when you have, with the Afghans, you have to educate them. We're teaching them English. We're teaching them how to read and write their own language. They're brilliant people. They speak five languages, but they can't read and write their own name. That's the challenge, and I'll shorten it up, but that's the answer to your question. It's educating them and getting them to understand exactly what basic fundamentals of education are. And once you really can get that across to them, you would be surprised. I mean, the proverbial light bulb goes off in their head. Teaching somebody to write their own name makes men be men in that culture. And to be able to see a grown man, a tribal leader, a Mujahideen fighter that used to fight the Soviets and now is working with us to teach that man to write his own language or write his own name in his own language, you can't put a price tag on that. And those people will be loyal to you for something so simple until the day that they die.
Major Bradley, let's stick with this subject of what it's like to have the mission of training the Afghan soldiers whose responsibility it's going to be to carry the fight to the enemy in the coming years as Americans pull out. Beth is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Beth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you, Major, for speaking to us today. My question is about the training that you're doing of the Afghanis. How do you know that you're strictly training the good guys and that there aren't some of the insurgents slipping in? How do you tell them apart?
You know, Rusty, we've had, unfortunately, many sad cases where Afghan soldiers and Afghan police have turned out to be Taliban sympathizers, right, and actually turned their weapons on their alleged American allies. You must have seen some situations like that.
Yes, Tom. First of all, Beth, thank you for having me on today. The answer to that question is simple. You can't.
You can't tell the good guys from the bad guys.
You can't tell the good guys from the bad. You depending upon where you work after you've been there for a while, you kind of can, because sometimes it's as simple as they'll give you the stink eye, and when they think you're not looking, and that'll sort of set off your spider senses. But most of the time, you just can't. And you know, I would be to actually steal a scene out of the movie The Green Berets with John Wayne. It's not foolishness to say I've had Taliban in my camp. I've had Taliban in my own ranks. What's interesting though is that as strange or fearful as that may seem, we've been able to recruit some of them right out from under the ideology of the Taliban, because they end up working with us. They see that we feed them properly. We treat them humanely. We push them and test them and build their confidence and their loyalty. And then the real bread and butter comes down after you've worked with them for a while. They make it through the training. You put them, you put them in a situation where they're going to end up in a firefight, and you have to watch them pretty carefully.
Cross your fingers.
you do, but there are always going to be. There is no such thing as a perfect solution. There are always going to be. That's like saying that there's, people are not going to steal money from a bank if they work in a bank, or in some other industry, people are not going to do something wrong. These things do happen, and you can't underestimate the power of some of these terrorist organizations. But at the end of the day, we've done a pretty decent job at being able to, the ones we can identify, we recruit them right out from under them. And because they see that we're what they've been told in the madrasas and by the, you know, the mullahs in Pakistan is not true. So we just show them by example. And they believe it.
But you have had some incidents, Rusty, where you had killings in units under your command?
No, not in my command.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, we're almost out of time in this segment, but I do want you to quickly explain this subtitle of your book. You say it's the story of a fight against all odds. You're with the most powerful military in the world. In what sense is your fight against the Taliban such that you have to say it's against all odds?
I think that's really a hard answer. It's not a fight against all odds necessarily between the U.S. military and the Taliban. We are up against some pretty stiff challenges in trying to get the Afghan people to understand, because they're so tied to geographically to the Taliban and some of the clans and tribes that are associated with the Taliban, that, you know, by genealogy, and they grow up to expect to be Taliban fighters. The challenge is the getting the Afghan people themselves to understand what's going on and for them to want to make the change themselves.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. Today we're talking about the war in Afghanistan and what 10 years of war have meant for the soldiers who are on the front lines. Divorce rates are high in the military, the special forces as well. Many soldiers have been deployed multiple times. Morale across the military is not as high as it was last year. Today I'm joined by Rusty Bradley, an active duty member of the special forces and veteran of the Afghan War. Major Bradley, speaking of morale, tell us what the killing of Osama bin Laden meant to you and your fellow soldiers. You're talking here about the personification of the enemy you had been fighting against for 9 years, right?
Yes, sir, absolutely.
And what was that like when you heard that news?
I think a lot of it was a sense of fulfillment, that, you know, knowing that he was finally dead, relief. I hoped in some small part that, his death brings some sort of closure to the thousands of people that, you know, he murdered across the world for his definition of jihad. But, Bin Laden's death's a great victory, and what's been a very long war. But there's a lot more battles that are going to need to be fought. You know, the Taliban are gearing up for this summer, and we've had such a successful year. You know, we're really pushing to, you know, maintain the gains that and expand the gains that we've been able to make over the winter and over the past year. You know, progress is fragile, but it is what it is. It's progress. We are making a lot of headway. So the thing I remember most is a quote by George W. Bush, and it said, you know, whether we bring our enemies to justice or justice to our enemies, justice will be served. And I think it sent a significant lesson to people who threaten us or our nation and our way of life, that if it takes us 10 years, we will eventually find you and we will deal with you.
Well, Rusty, you've only been back 2 weeks, but I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you to learn that the American people are getting really impatient about this war. Some of the latest polls are actually suggesting that most Americans think it's time to bring the troops home and call it a day in Afghanistan. We have somebody named Corey who's writing on the On Point website who says, "Tales of heroism in a war that makes no sense and has no end. Bring our armed forces home immediately." I'm sure that you are coming across some of this sentiment. How do you respond to that, Rusty?
I think, in all honesty, I'm more than willing to talk and engage with people who have these sort of feelings, and I do understand, surprisingly, where they're coming from. But I think what they have to do is understand at the end of the day, you know, one of my commanders always used to say, you know, remember, you're looking at a small piece of the pie, I'm looking at a much bigger one. And that's what I would explain to people is, this is what we do for a living. We make our careers and we are professional warriors. And I work for and have worked for some exceptional commanders. And they understand what they're doing. And I think at the end of the day, it's about letting the commanders in the field make the decision. Don't, you know, this is not a football game. It's not going to start and end in 2 hours, and your team's not necessarily going to be the highest scorer. Let's let the guys who do this for a living, let them do what they do best. And all we need to do is support them. And, you know, even when I'm not deployed, that's what, you know, one of my responsibilities is doing, is supporting the other guys that are over there that I rotate out with. So that's what I would tell them, is we're making progress. I think that's the big thing that I'm probably the most frustrated with, is that the amount of success that we're having. Can I give a real quick example?
Real quick.
Long story short, I was in a bazaar. I just finished this rotation in the same place where I wrote this book about. But instead of fighting a massive battle this time, I focused on doing development, reconstruction, and helping to assist in the newly established governance that's in the Panjwid district. I fought a firefight in the same bazaar, which is a local market area, 4 years ago. And I drove through that bazaar 8 months ago, and 300 children were running through the streets with their little school uniforms on. Women were shopping in the bazaar with their children, without their husbands. New shops had opened. Commerce was better than it had ever been. There were more people actually physically out of their villages coming and having tea and doing what normal villages should be doing. That would have been unheard of 4 years ago. That's what's going on right now in the birthplace of the Taliban. So when people say, oh, it's endless, we're not making any ground, I'll say, you know, ask somebody who's been over there and spent a little time before you formulate an opinion and put it out publicly.
Okay, Rusty, I'm going to put you on the line now with Al, who's calling from Malden, Massachusetts. Hello, Al. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Major, and I sincerely appreciate your service in all sincere terms. But as a veteran, but not a combat veteran of Vietnam, I witnessed your counterparts at that time taking in a prisoner, a Viet Cong prisoner, and he had the typical garb. It was astonishing to me to see this. He had the black garb and the sandals made of car tires, and here he was determined to kill us. At the same time, a battle was going on, and I witnessed it from afar because I was in the transportation department. I witnessed this from afar. It was going on for at least 3 months in an area that you could see visually the size of a small town, and nothing happened. After I left Vietnam, that battle was still going on.
And Rusty, do you think that that would apply to your situation in Afghanistan as well?
I think what Special Operations is, and Special Forces in particular, has done is we looked and talked heavily with a lot of the Vietnam veterans, and the things that we did right and the things that we did wrong in Vietnam. You got to remember, we don't drive politics; we drive military operations and not strategy. But we have tried to take and apply a lot of the mistakes and successes in the appropriate places into what we're doing now. So I think we've taken a different approach, a more successful approach to what's been going on. And our commanders, again, are exceptionally brilliant, adaptive, and I wouldn't make necessarily the same comparisons, because I think there are a lot of things that are the same, but there are also a lot of things that are different.
Mm-hmm. Major Bradley, we have another soldier calling now, Peter from Fort Knox in Kentucky. Peter, you're on the air. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Sir, I just wanted to ask what your experiences were in Afghanistan. I've done Iraq twice in 06, 07, and 08, 09, and I've yet to do Afghanistan. So I was wondering, A, have you done an Iraq tour? And if so, how is that in comparison to Afghanistan? Or I'm not really sure to put the question, but I think you get the point.
You got any advice for Peter?
Hey, Peter, you know, I have not even stepped foot in Iraq, which is, it's been a point of study for me, because I've been very interested in talking with a lot of the SF guys and conventional guys that have spent time in Iraq, because I know that, you know, Afghanistan's apples and Iraq is oranges. They're both fruit, but they're both very different. And I have not, but I would tell you that as long as, you know, if you're going to go to Afghanistan, you know, as long as you remember that, you know, you are doing population-centric operations, you are there to work with the Afghan people. And at the end of the day, the Afghan people are starting to push the insurgency out on their own. The Afghan National Security Forces are building and growing. You know, we're there to assist them in creating their own country. They've created their own government. And, you know, as long as you go in with your eyes wide open, but, you know, remember that that's what you're there to do. I feel like what I think probably my grandfather felt like during World War II.
You know, it's just remarkable, Rusty, that you've had 5 deployments to Afghanistan and you still have this, and what you've gone through, and you still have this positive attitude toward the mission, toward your experience there. But the truth is, isn't it, that that this has put a real, these operations have put a real strain on our military and on their families. We mentioned at the top that divorce rates are high. How realistic is it, do you think, to keep this operational tempo at the point it's at right now? Can this go on indefinitely?
You know, honestly, that's Tom, that's not a question I can answer. That's probably up to the that's up to the Secretary of the Army. I mean, the Army commander.
But you've certainly seen the strain on
Chairman
your fellow
of the Joint Chiefs, and not in SecDef. That's not up to me.
But you have seen the strain on your fellow soldiers, I'm sure.
Oh, I mean, if you do one rotation, if you do one tour to a combat zone, it's stressful. Multiple rotations are. And, you know, I can't speak for the conventional commanders. I know a lot of the, particular to the 82nd, I served under a lot of the commanders that are there. And they do everything within their power to ensure that they accomplish the mission, and they also, you know, serve to look after the welfare of their men. And things are difficult, but you know what? These are difficult times, and what we've got to remember is you never give up, and we will find a way to do what needs to be done and accomplish the missions that we're given. That's what we do. That's who we are. That's our generation. And that's our responsibility. You know, to whom much is given, much is expected. And we're going to follow through with that.
And, Rusty, I want to go now to another listener, Penny, who is calling from Lincoln, Nebraska. Hello, Penny. Welcome to On Point.
Major, what's a great lead into my question. With all you've been through, I'm curious to know if you suffer from PTSD. If not, do you have any insight as to why not, and are there any lessons there for those for the rest of the service in helping to prevent that terrible response from for other soldiers?
Penny, wow, what a great question. I mean, of course, I'll be very honest with you. After I got injured during this battle, I was not nearly as badly injured as some of my soldiers were. A lot of mine were blast injuries. But, you come home and, I think probably the worst thing that you have to live with as a commander is losing any of your men. And my team sergeant was killed. And I think, including myself, 9 of the guys on my team were wounded in some way. So when I came home and started, surgery and physical therapy, I realized I did have PTSD. And the Army is very quick to come in and to help you if you need help. And in my particular case, it took me probably about a year to maybe a year and a half, depending upon how you ask, but to get back in the saddle. And for me, it was about getting back on focus. For me, it was about staying with my soldiers and my brothers and the guys in my unit and fulfilling my responsibility and obligation to them to get back in it, because some of those guys were wounded and they begged, borrowed, and stealed everything they could to either stay out there in the fight or to get back from the hospital in Kandahar and get back out to us. So, they set the example for me to get back in the saddle and to get back into the fight, and that's just the way that we're trained. And for me personally, that's what I needed, was I needed to get back involved with the men that I admire so greatly.
We have a time for one more very quick call. Andy from Charleston, South Carolina, if you have a very quick question or a quick comment, this is your chance.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Major. Thanks for your service. I am a reservist, and I was activated for 3 years as a pilot. And from that, I was injured, and it forced me to lose my full-time job. The military has basically flushed me down the toilet as far as taking care of me. When I was there, I experienced our equipment getting worn out. As an F-16 pilot, the sand that goes into the airplanes, it just degrades the plane. They're getting worn out. The hours that are flown on the planes are getting worn out. The soldiers are getting worn out. And what our country isn't looking at is this war on terror is like a war on fear. There's always going to be some nut that wants to blow something up to prove a point. And I just strongly think we need to end that and let the special forces guys like the major handle special operations in a secret way, and we'd be much more effective in taking care of the bad guys that want to harm our country.
Rusty, a real quick final thought, but then we'll have to close the program.
I'm really sorry to hear about that sort of experience that you've had. I agree with you. A lot of a lot of the equipment does need replacing, but we're seeing in Afghanistan we're seeing the equipment start to come in. So I can't speak on what the SF should be doing. I can only tell you what we are doing. And I'm really sorry to hear that you didn't have a really good experience. But I thank you for your service, and I wish you Godspeed.
Well, that's Major Rusty Bradley. His new book, Lions of Kandahar, The Story of a Fight Against All Odds, tells the story of what Major Bradley's experience has been in Afghanistan. Rusty, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We've been talking here about the war in Afghanistan and what lies ahead. It's a subject we're going to be coming back to in future programs, I'm sure. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.